Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me is...
Jason Bartsch, and I believe we are keeping the special guest hit train coming, right, John?
Oh, yeah. So we have the writer from such publications as Movie John, Findy, and he's the host of podcasts I Like to Movie Movie and Hot Property. Dan Scully, everyone.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I appreciate that you called me the writer as opposed to a writer. It's definitely like an ego boost. And I love, like, he's the writer from Movie John. There's like 100 writers on that site, but I'm happy to be the writer.
Well, you'll be getting a strongly worded email from them.
Yeah. Like, whoa, 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 whoa. Spread the wealth. Like, listen, they'll have you on the show.
Well, since you're on our podcast, you're the only writer there that matters. So,
thanks. Thanks, guys. No, seriously, though, thank you for having me. This is cool. I love talking horror movies. I'm wearing my Camp Blood shirt from the Mahoning Drive-In.
Oh, nice.
To celebrate.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Have you guys been there before?
I haven't yet, but I was hoping to go there for the Dawn of the Dead screening. I think in a month or two.
It's definitely worth the drive.
I haven't been there either, but I know the guy who did the movie at the drive-in. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a documentary about the Mahoning Drive-in. It's really great.
Yeah, that's a great documentary. I saw that before I had ever been there, but yeah, highly recommend taking the trip out there. It is worth it. Whatever discomforts you have to go through to get to the Mahoning, it's worth it. Do it.
Yeah. It's so secluded too. It's like you just like happen upon it when, you know, you're driving from A to B.
Oh yeah. You're in the middle of, I mean, there's like an airport behind it. You know, it's just in the middle of like, no, like a little like biplanes airport. It's incredible. I saw Texas Chainsaw there last year. And that was very, very cool to just be sitting in the outdoors surrounded by trees and such. And just the beautiful music of a chainsaw rocketing off of a sea of FM radios. It was beautiful.
That's lovely. All right. Well, so let's move on to what we've been watching. Dan, what have you been watching?
I mean, this weekend I started going through all of the Saws again.
Oh.
In the interest of getting boned up on it for the new From the Book of Saw, whatever the hell that means.
Oh, is that the Chris Rock one?
That's the Chris Rock one. Yeah. Which is going to be crazy. I hope it's good, but I mean, it's from the director of many of the Saw sequels, and having gotten through the first three over the weekend, like the sequels aren't really that great. Like, it's kind of crappy, but like, tons of fun. I do love it. But if I were to highlight like a great thing that I watched, have you ever heard of Death Promise?
Death Promise, no.
I first came across Death Promise at an Exhumed Films event a few years back. And it is, I think Vinegar Syndrome put out a Blu-ray. And I immediately bought it because this is just one of those weird like movies that you're not going to really find anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it's from the 70s. It's a 1977. And it is a karate movie that stars Charles Dorset, who was billed as the Latino Bruce Lee. And he plays a guy who lives in like a tenement building. And there's an evil cabal of landlords that kill his father. And so now him and his buddy Speedy Leacock are teaming up to kill all of the landlords using karate. And it is unbelievable. Oh, it's really, really incredible. Like, to the point where like he goes to the Far East for training and they're like, your skills are bad. He's like, you got to teach me how to kill, damn it. And it's very weird, but it's almost like, have you seen Boogie Nights?
Oh yeah.
You know, the Chest Rockwell, Brock Landers movies.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
it's
yeah, yeah.
Very, very similar to that in tone, but it's completely serious. And Boogie Nights is my favorite movie. So as an offshoot, Death Promise is like the thing. And I watched that the other day as I recovered from my second vaccine. So it was a nice little like hangover day, if you will.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
Highly recommend getting your hands on Death Promise.
I'll look into that. So, Jason, what have you been watching?
So I don't have anything on the horror front, but I did watch that newish Netflix movie called Bad Trip. Eric Andre. It's like,
I saw a girl today. It's so funny.
So it's like the premise is it's like a narrative film. It's Eric Andre and what's his name from Get Out?
Lil Rel Howery.
Yeah. And it's narrative, but it's also a kind of hidden camera prank show. Mm-hmm. So they basically went through the plot, but then shot each scene each necessary scene is like a hidden camera show, basically. And they tried it with a bunch of different people and then just picked the best one. And oh man, he's like, I don't know, Eric Andre can be hit or miss for me, but it's funny. It's a good, like, kind of late night movie to watch, I guess. But
I think the superstar in that was Tiffany Haddish.
Oh yeah.
When she's fresh out of jail and that poor guy that, like, when she gets out of the bus and that poor guy, like, doesn't want to turn his back.
Yeah.
He's like, just go. I felt so bad for him. But, like, that is so, man, they really played that hard. That was that's one of the better prank movies.
Yeah. And they had some great participants in that. Unwilling participants, but I was very surprised at how, like, the way that people played along with some of these pranks. John, the opening scene, he's like, Eric Andre is vacuuming out his car and he sees his high school crush walking by, and there's like a guy sitting there, and he's like telling him all about his high school crush, and he's like, you should go talk to her. And then he ends up, like, putting the vacuum, like, on his outfit, and it just sucks off his entire outfit, and he's like completely naked, and it's just so ridiculous. It's like that sets the stage for the film. But
everybody's so, like, enthused about helping him find his love. Like the character that Eric Andre is playing, like, the story is like, we're going on a road trip so I can finally meet this girl. Like every early 2000s, late 90s, mm-hmm. you know, road trip, girl next door, all that kind of stuff. And so he really plays that plucky character. Like, I'm going to find love. Oh man, she's perfect, but I'm just a nerd. And so anytime these people get put into a situation where he gets made, you know, he's the embarrassed one, everyone's like, no man, you gotta go get her, you're in love. But, like, people are so supportive of it. He's really good at like, I guess, just disarming people. It's not like a Jackass kind of thing where they're trying to be combative. It's like he's kind of the butt of the joke. It's very well done. Yeah.
And he puts himself in very uncomfortable situations.
Well, so, it sounds like I'm missing out, and I need to check that out immediately. So
it's a laugh riot, and laugh is spelled LAFF. It's one of those.
So, John, what have you been watching?
All right. So I watched a movie called Night of the Creeps, which, amazing movie. I think the best way to describe this movie is, like, the tagline is, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is your dates are here. What's the bad news? They're dead. And I mean, that sets it up perfectly. It's like, it's a horror movie. It's really funny. It's got Fred Dekker, who would go on to do Monster Squad and with Shane Black. So if you like Shane Black's kind of humor, there's a lot of that in there. Also, another thing, Tom Atkins is in it, and it might be one of his best roles. And he's a cop. And whenever he answers the phone, he just goes, thrill me.
My God, he's the best. And he's still kicking. One of those heroes that's still out there in the world.
Yeah, he was on, I was watching, there's like a really long 80s horror movie thing on Shudder. It's like 4.5 hours long. And whenever he's, like, interviewed, nobody seems to be having as great a time as he is talking about, like, the movies that he's been in or other cool horror movies and stuff. He just seems to be having a great time. Lovely man, it seems.
We need that enthusiasm.
Cool. Yeah, we do.
He reminds me of, and I always say this on I Like to Movie, one of the reasons I love watching Kurt Russell is that no matter what movie he's in, you can tell he's very much enjoying being in it.
Oh, that's Atkins
is very much one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kurt Russell, Dolly Parton, and Tom Atkins. They are always enjoying it no matter what the quality of the movie they're in. Fred Dekker, who also went on to do RoboCop 3, the one where RoboCop flies. He has a jetpack in that movie. That's the only thing that movie has going for it, really. It's not that great. They're like, let's make it a kids movie, and then sure, and then it didn't work.
For some reason, when you said that, I was imagining him, like, as it's like a new power, not that it's like motivated by anything. You know, like, all of a sudden he just flies and no one addresses it.
Like, he's like, I can feel love again. It's just quite literally he has jetpacks in his shoulders now. That's all it is. I think the action figure probably was invented first, and they were like, get us a RoboCop jetpack movie. We gotta sell these units.
Oh man. All right, so let's move on to our review of Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
So Behind the Mask is a mockumentary slash narrative film. And the synopsis is a grad school documentary film crew is given unprecedented access into the world of aspiring serial killer Leslie Vernon. As Leslie plans for his next killing spree, the crew must decide how far they're willing to go for their film, as well as how much they're able to intervene until they risk becoming targets themselves. So I really enjoyed this film. I was a little annoyed. I think I've vented about this before on the podcast because I had a what I thought was a very original idea for a very similar type movie. Apparently like 5 years after this came out. So I was disappointed to learn of its existence. But
it was called The Ascent of Wesley Learning.
But it's so refreshing to watch, especially after we're over halfway through our slasher miniseries at this point. And it just really calls attention to, you know, a lot of the tropes and just kind of like the funny things you think about when you're watching these horror films, like, you know, what this killer had to go through to get in the situation and, you know, for everything to work out to his advantage. And, you know, this mockumentary kind of digs into the prep work that goes into being a serial killer. So, John, what are your thoughts?
What I like about it is that it turns the like the serial killer like model as like a trade craft that you have to like learn how to do these things properly. It's kind of a weird like process movie where like it is kind of thrilling when they show you how he like messes with people. I will say that my friend Joey, who I think listens to the podcast still, he's been bugging me to watch this for years. I think I've had his Blu-ray for about 4 or 5 years now. So, anyway, thanks, Joey. You were correct. This is good.
Did you end up just watching it on Shudder anyway? Probably. Screw his Blu-ray. It was on Prime.
No comment.
Joey, I just got to say, Joey, I feel for you. It's hard for me to get John to watch movies as well. So maybe we can start a support group. You know, find me online.
Should do an alternate podcast with Joey. Joe and Jason, you know, actually watch the movies that John has recommended, but left off the shorter title. But, you know, the gist of it.
Yeah, that's a good working title.
Just go over the anagram. Maybe we can spell something with the anagram and it'll happen there. I mean, to build off what you said, John, about Behind the Mask, I think what's so funny about it is the way that it attacks formula. Mm-hmm. And kind of unpacks the formula by just showing it through the eyes of the killer. Because, you know, we understand the formula and it's always through our protagonist is usually the ultimate final girl. And so she has those spooky moments like at the dumpster behind the restaurant and things like that, that for us, it's just formula as, oh yeah, that's how these movies are done. But to see it as, oh no, this is how the killer planned it, because we live in a world that's informed by these movies, I think is such a really good way of just exploring the formula of these movies, poking fun at it, but doing it in a way that's kind of from an angle of love towards the movies. It's not mocking slashers for having formula. It's kind of an homage to it. But I like this movie quite a bit. I saw it for the first time many, many years ago when it kind of first dropped and everyone's like, hey, it's kind of cheap, but it's smarter than you'd think. And so I was afraid that it wouldn't hold up, but I think it held up quite well this time around.
Yeah, no, I was thinking that it was kind of amazing how much like it still is relevant to horror movies in general. And like there's been, you know, over a decade's worth of like new horror that's come out. Things have changed and whatnot, but it still feels like it's like on top of everything and just being
slashers do stick to the formula still. And even when they subvert the formula, like, we've almost reached a point where like those formulaic pieces of even like more recent slashers are like touchstones now, where it feels less like formula. It's like, no, we got to go there. This is what they want. You know, this right. is what the audience came to see with these.
I would also say I like the characterization of Leslie is really, I think it's really interesting because I don't know, like he's almost like a skater or something. Like he kind of has like a little bit of that kind of vibe to him, or a BMX guy or something. And He's got like this very like mid-2000s kind of energy to him.
And, oh, yeah.
And
he feels like he could have been on like the Jackass crew or the Tom Green crew kind of thing.
Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting kind of like move for them to go with a character like that. And he's really enjoyable to watch. And then when he like is successful in like scaring people or whatever, he has like a very like celebratory kind of like attitude afterwards. Like,
yeah,
we did it. Yes. And it's like, you kind of get wrapped up in it too. So
yeah, I love how goofy they made him and just like how he's such like a purist and such a fan of the process. And like, you know, when the crew asks certain questions, he's almost like insulted that they would think that's how the process is. Like, you know, you can't just pick victims. They got to have this, that they got to have, you know, you got to check all the boxes here. And I don't know. I just like, they could have easily made him like a real creep, but they made him just kind of like a normal guy. I feel like we all know a guy sort of like this, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of high energy guy who's always down to like talk about the process of what he loves to do.
Yeah, he's
almost like a riff on like a Randy character from Scream, where mm-hmm. he's a guy who's clearly a fan of this. He understands the formula, but you know, he's not happy to just be a critic. He actually wants to make the movie, you know,
right?
For lack of a better term.
Also, like he's got a little bit of the like some of those like those magician guys you see on TV. Like he's got a little bit of that too, where he's kind of like him like tricking people is like really like I got you.
Yeah. He does that thing where like if you were like I don't know many magicians, but where you go like, oh hey, how does this happen? And then they go, okay, well let me just show you a little something. Boom, boom, how'd I do that? And they're like so impressed with like, see, I have the knowledge you don't. And he sort of has that, like if we were to say like, oh, so why do you kill this person, he wouldn't just be like, well, I do it because of this. He'd be like, let me ask you, if this were the, you know, he kind of goes that way with it, where he's yeah, like
right,
he almost has like this like patriarchal mentality of like, take a walk with me. We're gonna learn something here. I'm gonna learn you something real good about Yoda.
I liked when he's like, do you have a deck of cards? And the guy's like, why would I have a deck of cards? Like, check your front pocket. And he goes, oh my god. And he's like, yeah.
Exactly that. I think it's wild too, at the outset of this movie, and correct me if I'm wrong, it is established that slashers like Jason and Michael Myers, they're all in-world real existing killers.
Yeah,
I thought that, I forgot about that touch, and I think that is such an interesting touch, and it's kind of crucial to make any leaps in what's the word, believability. Mm-hmm. Any leaps in believability are easy to swallow because of that at the outset. But when they talk about Freddy Krueger, they actually kind of bring it into the real world, and they say that he used to be a murderer, and now people are so scared by him that they often have nightmares about him, as opposed to being supernatural. I really appreciated that. You know, and that's a great way to bring it into, you know, bring it into the real world, but also make this real world, you know, a little bit more fiction than the actual real world. Very smart move to establish it like that.
Yeah, I thought that was such a nice touch, especially, you know, at the very beginning of the movie as part of the setup. And, you know, you got the B-roll of the towns and everything, like the documentary crew went all out to like show these locations as if, you know, it's all part of the same world. And that was really effective.
Then we also have Eugene, who is the mentor for Leslie. And he's like talking about like, yeah, you know, Jay, Mike and Fred, they really changed the game.
Yeah. Now, I read somewhere that he's supposed to be Billy from Black Christmas. And they don't
say
it in the text of the movie, but that was the intention. And also as to why his wife is a considerably younger, sexy lady, is that she could have perhaps been one of his final girls, that because they are, you know, bonded as it were, they are Batman and the Joker to a degree. They are now married, you know, in service of this cause.
Wow.
There's nothing in the text of the movie that says that, but as I was reading, you know, that seemed to be what the general consensus is that he was supposed to represent. And I'm into that.
That's awesome.
I'll put that in my headcanon. Whether that's
it adds up, because what did he say? He did most of his work in the 60s and 70s or something like that. And, you know, when he's talking about his past.
Oh, yeah. And I also like that him and his wife have like what it seems like a very like healthy, like happy relationship, that they both seem really like into each other.
Well, I mean, I get that vibe off of Leslie, too. Like Leslie, despite being someone who murders, he doesn't play as like a murderer. He plays as a hobbyist who's very enthused about it, and thus you know, is very confident and put together, doesn't live in a world of doubt like so many of us do. And I think that's sort of, you know, the vibe that Billy and his wife have too.
And he's very eager to share his story and his process. Like he's
I call him Billy, Eugene.
You know, anyone who will listen, you know, Leslie is like, just is dying to share his process with people.
He's proud of his work. He's a creator.
So I guess the thing, when I first watched it, I was kind of wondering if you buy that Taylor would have wanted to do a documentary with him. If, you know, she seems later, you know, obviously later on in the movie, she tries to stop him. But like, I kind of think it works that she would want to, you know, film him and stuff because he is like, he has a lot of charisma. It does seem a lot of fun to watch him do these things, you know, up to the killing part. And I guess I could see like a journalist person, you know, just, I don't know, trying to make some sort of rational argument to be like, well, it's a good story, you know?
And I think that goes to that weird world that they're in. Like there, mm-hmm. there is this world where there are, where, you know, slashers are kind of a part of life. You know, what with Michael Myers and all them being real, as it were. But I think also too, it speaks to Leslie's like sales pitch. Cause I would imagine that he approached her, and as you know, we'll get into the plot wise why that's probably true. I could see, you know, him pitching that and just being like, listen, I just want you to film it. I'll take the fall, whatever it is. Like, just we want you there for the camera. Can you imagine, you know, what kind of career you'll have as the person who filmed this? Just think about it. And I feel like that's a dangling carrot that a lot of people who are inclined to make a documentary would be remiss to let pass by.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I was thinking the same thing, like what Dan just said. The fact that they established that, you know, Michael and Freddie and Jason are real in this world, it adds to the believability that, you know, this documentary crew would want to do this. And I honestly, I was wondering how they were going to handle that kind of ethical aspect of the film, you know, like once they get into the killing. And, you know, I think they played it nicely where it's like, you know, they go so far until they start feeling this ethical dilemma to intervene. And I don't know. I just like I feel like the documentary crew got into it not even sure themselves how they would react. And it kind of felt like they were kind of figuring it out as they went along. And they were kind of, you know, they seemed pretty legitimately shocked. You know, their points were like, this is actually happening. Like they almost didn't know what they were getting into.
Yeah, it's not till the first kill that they suddenly go like, wait a minute, this is bad news. Yeah. You know, like until then, it's all well and good and good fun.
Well, and he's been so friendly. It's like, you know, they probably almost forgot about that aspect of it. He's just been like a joy to talk to. They're gone to dinner parties, meeting his friends. And then, you know, once they get into it, it gets real.
And it's easy to get wrapped up into the like the thrill of what he's doing up to that point.
Oh, yeah.
So
I think any stupid event that I've ever gotten caught up into, I never realize how stupid it is or in how much trouble I'm in until it's like one step too late. You know, like the party that goes a little too far.
Yeah.
It's all so much fun. And then as soon as you get that one inch over the line, it's like, I told myself this was going to happen. I knew this was going to happen and I didn't listen. And now we're screwed. And I think that energy is captured pretty well through, especially in like the cameraman and like the sound guy, you know, they kind of have like, you know, that sort of like, crap, we went a little too far.
Also, I kind of think Taylor, I think she's like got a thing for Leslie. It feels that way that she kind of can, his charisma really works on her, I'll say.
Well, yeah, I think that she has a
fascination with him.
Yeah. And she has a similar ego, because whereas he's like, I'm going to create something amazing here with my work and I'm going to be the counterpoint to goodness because that's how it works. She's sort of thinking the same thing, which is I'm going to make the movie that everyone else is afraid to make. And she seems to be making it from a similar point of, you know, some ego and some love for the craft.
Yeah. And I think that's why it works so great too. The little detail that they're grad school students. They're not just regular documentary filmmakers. Cause when you're in school, there's that kind of instinct to outdo your classmates and to kind of have that one project that kind of stands out. And I think they kind of all had their eyes on that a little bit too, as opposed to it just being some random documentary crew.
Oh, certainly.
You have moments where she is kind of putting on a little bit of airs as like she talks about certain aspects of the story in front of the camera, where she gets very serious and very like, I'm trying to be like taken seriously as a reporter and whatnot. Like, mm-hmm. like you have that part where one of the camera guys asks Leslie a question. He starts to answer and they're like, oh, maybe Taylor, maybe you should actually ask that question. And then she like yeah. gets very serious and then like adds on to it to kind of add some dramatic
she spices it up a little bit.
Yeah.
She gives it a little zazz. Yeah.
She reminded me of the chick from Blair Witch Project, especially at the beginning, you know, yeah. kind of how she very, very seriously and methodically went over all these killings and set up the documentary. And you know, I like that aspect of it.
And that is a subset now of like news blooper videos. That's like a subset of our culture now where you see the reporter being very, very, you know, specific and blah, blah, blah. And then the camera cuts and they're like, oh, and they immediately turn back into a regular person. And like right. they captured that a couple times with her. And I think it speaks to her awareness of what she can be on the film.
Absolutely.
I'm reminded this is sort of an adjacent thing. I have not read this yet, but I was just recommended a brand new comic book that's out called Maniac of New York. And the plot of it is a Jason style killer that is unkillable and unstoppable appears in New York and becomes just a regular part of life. And this is, you know, because he's unkillable, it essentially like the governmental decree is just like, there are many hazards to living in the city. One of them is the maniac, and that's just what we're going to have to deal with. And so there's only like 3 or 4 issues out. So I'm waiting for a trade so I can get mm-hmm. the, you know, the whole schlemiel schlemazel. And, but like, what a great concept. And I feel like this world is sort of similar to that. I feel like there is the, you know, it's not, I don't think there's any suggestion of supernatural in the world of Behind the Mask, but there is sort of a like, nope, these are the rules. This is how, you know, if you're a jock and a slut and a virgin hanging out, well, yeah, you might just attract a killer. This is the way it is.
I mean, just with what's been going on with COVID and stuff, we can kind of see people being like, things become a new normal. And then they're just like, well, that's just how it is now, right? Like, we're just gonna...
Yeah, we just gotta go with it.
Yeah. So why don't we get into the plot of the movie? All right. So the first...
No!
What if I back down now? What if I was like, oh, okay. It's your podcast now.
Didn't you read Dan's contract stipulations? No plot.
No plot. We discuss movies on feeling and only feeling. That's it. And if there's topless women in it, we'll discuss that. And then I draw the line. That's it.
But Dan has to bring it up.
Yeah.
Watching it a second time, I did forget about there's like a gratuitous like shot of like woman's breasts. And like, she's like, oh, is this really necessary? I think she says. And I think he calls her, don't be a prude.
He's like, it's my story.
Or, it's my story. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's another great, like, that is the conversation around slashers, because, you know, in the 80s, that was a big thing. It was, we got to get the 15-year-old boys in here. So let's get some boobs hanging out. And, you know, then the conversation naturally and correctly is like, but what is there a story element to this? But it has become a touchstone now. Yeah. In the remake of Friday the 13th, they sort of do like a fun way of subverting that, because they're like, well, these movies were made by a porn producer and they could, you know, accurately be referred to as, air quotes, titty movies. And so we have to deliver on that front. But I think the remake came out in like 2009. Mm-hmm. So it's like, but we've had the conversation about whether this is misogynist or not. So what do we do with that? And so like, it was interesting to see how that is. But if it wasn't there in the remake, it would feel like a piece was missing.
Yeah.
And so I think that Behind the Mask commenting on it is a smart move. And then a clever move, because it is a real conversation that was had.
Absolutely. All right. So the start of the movie, we get a new segment with Taylor, and we alluded to this earlier. She kind of explains that Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger, Jason Voorhees, like all the serial killer guys from horror movies, they're all real. And then she pivots to talking about the story of Leslie Vernon, who was thrown over a waterfall. And, you know, because he was possessed by evil, right? That's obviously what you do. Oh, he's evil. Throw him over a waterfall.
Another classic thing, though. I mean, like, how many monsters have drawn the ire of an entire town that are just like, we're good people, but he's got a bird. You know?
Well, we just did a review recently of a Nightmare. And like, that was like kind of a thing that's like revealed towards the end, that like the whole town killed Freddy. And then the, you know, the cop family, like they actually have Freddy's like glove in their basement as like a little bit of a, I don't know, a memento of, yeah, yeah, keepsake or memento.
Remind us of the monsters we all became for one night.
But yeah, so then we get to meet Leslie, where they go to his, I guess, his house that he's really living at. Then he starts to kind of give them like the rundown of what you need to do for like the proper planning for, I guess, his murder spree. So first,
yeah, he's got steps. He's got rules. he's a very organized man.
So step one, you got location. He shows the old Leslie Vernon house, and he says that's where like the kids go on like on the anniversary of his death. So then he shows also like step two, target group. And we get kind of a view of like how he would like scout out a crew. So it's got to have jocks and stoners.
Yeah. And he just takes him to a random high school to like point him out. He's like, yeah, these aren't the real ones, but you know, this is how I would go about it.
Yeah, but this pattern exists in this world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and it kind of does in the real world to a degree, but you know, these are heightened tropes in a slasher movie. And so I love that in this world, it's like, no, that's exactly how it is. We got the jock, we've got the virgin, we've got the stoners.
I like when the girl, he's like pointing out like, oh, she's the virgin, and then she kind of senses like, you know, a whole van of people staring at her.
Yeah.
And he's like, did you get that?
But he even says like, there's a connection there. Yeah. And like, that once again also just speaks to like, yeah, those are the rules of this world. Mm-hmm. Is that it's the virgin who's going to be pure enough to notice that she's being hunted.
Mm-hmm.
And like that fits into the weird dated you know, morality play of a slasher movie, where it is like, oh, you're not a virgin, you gotta die because you're not pure. You know, and that's like the really ham-handed, you know, ass backwards morality play as it was posited in the late 70s early 80s. And so I kind of love that from the killer's point of view, it's like, no, this is a connection that we share, you know, because she's pure, she can sense that I'm watching.
Yeah.
And, you know, like it's unspoken when we see it from the virgin's point of view, but from the killer's point of view, he's keyed into it. Like, no, this is how it works. I got this.
It's interesting too, how they like have like kind of a whole rationality to like what they're doing, of how like they're being evil to allow for
well, it's like they're counterbalancing like the whole idea of like, without evil there can be no good. Mm-hmm. And so in order to like inspire the goodness that it takes to I mean, like when a tragedy happens to Haddonfield, those people all gather together. Mm-hmm. And they find strength as a town in the face of you know, Michael Myers. Crystal Lake finds it in the face of Jason. Why can't I think of the Elm Street town? Whatever, they find it. The denizens of Elm Street find it in the face of Freddy. So it's like, yeah, he's acting to be like, I need to be this evil. Because, you know, and he doesn't even seem like an evil guy, but he's like, I need to represent this evil so that someone else can represent the good. They need that opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, this is the balancing of you know, we have to balance the force, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a little bit like, it's his calling and it's what he's very good at. And it would be a disservice for him to not be doing this. Basically, that's kind of how
yeah.
he approaches it.
Yeah, if it's not going to be him, it's going to be someone else, and they're not going to do it nearly as well.
Yeah.
And they're going to do it with a different understanding, and they might not do the evil right, and they might not inspire the right good.
So then we get to step three, which is we get to see a flyby, which so we mentioned this earlier, but this is the scene. So they show a clip of it at the very beginning of the movie, where Kelly goes out to the back of the restaurant and throws the trash into the dumpster. I don't know what's up with me today. So she,
it's all good.
So she,
John's never worked at a restaurant.
Yeah,
yes, I have. I used to take out the garbage.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I've been a busboy. I had to do that crap. Yeah.
I was a dishwasher. That was my first.
I was
job.
Trying to give you a pass. You didn't have to mention that.
Well, you're trying to make me seem like an elitist or something. Anyway,
so, and I've served in the trenches too, my friend. We can bond over that. Anyone who's ever worked in the restaurant industry knows that there it takes a certain type. When you get your restaurant stripes, ooh, they don't go away. Yeah. Seriously, a lot of my best friends are people that I worked with at Chili's a decade ago, just because we all saw the same shit. You
know, like, oh, yeah.
We're old.
No, you're buddies. Bonded for life. You're
for life. For real. Life we really are.
Yeah.
The cook at my restaurant actually intentionally burned me with a hot with a saute pan. And he's like, all right, now you've been initiated into the kitchen.
Jeez.
One of us.
I still have the burn on my leg.
Oh, that's horrible. But I bet a little piece of you was just like, that's right. Let's get to, you know, let's do this. Put me on that fryer. Let's feed these jackoffs. Let's go.
Okay, anyway.
Are you still friends with this guy?
I mean, he's like, I don't know, about 20 years older than me, and I don't know where he is.
But if you still put your scars up next to one another, it still makes a heart.
It's the restaurant logo.
Yeah. It's like Maggiano's.
Macaroni Grill, bro.
I had an audio project I had to do where I had to interview someone in community college, and I interviewed him about he got a concussion and then he didn't get it taken care of. Like, he didn't go to a doctor for like a week. So like, he started talking about all these like weird visions he was having because he did a lot of acid when he was younger. So he's like sitting like he's cooking, and then all of a sudden he's seeing like the Virgin Mary walking up to him and stuff. And so it was played in front of the class, and the class thought it was really funny, but my teacher was like, this guy doesn't sound real. And I was like, oh, he's very real.
He's real and he's funny and scary.
You can have it at the same ways. Time.
Yeah, once you get to know him, it's funny. He's our crazy person. But if you don't know him, then he's just that crazy guy on the fryer. Everybody, I have a couple friends like that where it's like, oh yeah, I wouldn't like this guy if I didn't already like this guy. But since he's my crazy person, yeah, he's not going to unleash his crazy on me. But, you know, back against the wall, I might be able to point his crazy at a threat and neutralize it. So he's good to keep around, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Some of your friends are just grandfathered in, and then like you have to like you have to explain them to your new friends. You're like, we go way back. You just have to know him. That's just how he is. He doesn't mean anything by it.
You pull out that lie where you go, oh, it's a work friend, which usually is just like, that's the big excuse. Like, oh, it's just a work friend.
So we're at the diner. Kelly is throwing out some trash into the dumpster, and we get the preamble of that where you see Leslie attaches some fishing line to the brick, and then we see like the whole way he sets it up to scare her. Afterwards, what I love is just him, they're all celebrating, and he's like, he's sticking his tongue out like, yeah, like he's a rock star. And I don't know, I like how he's like talking about she's not sure if she saw him, like she's not sure if she saw anything. And he's like, you know, you just need to kind of give her a little sense that there's something's happening here. And then in the background, you see like Robert Englund in his car, like just pull up, and they're like, who's that guy? I'm like, oh, don't worry about it. And then it just cuts to the next scene.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
So then we get to meet Eugene and his wife, Jamie, who... Leslie really likes Jamie.
Oh yeah.
I just don't think like refers to her big boobs just before she opens the door. He's such a bro. Well,
that is very much like what you said. Like, he very much feels like a, you know, early 2000s Jackassy character. Yeah, that's exactly what they go with.
Oh,
it's kind of bro-y. What I think's funny about that though is I think it speaks a little bit to like, what's the reason why every young man does something? Well, if you trace it back to its most pure essence, it's to get laid. Yeah. And I think there's a little bit of, well, there's like a little bit of like of like fantasy there. Mm-hmm. Is what she represents to him, I think, is, oh, I could be like Eugene one day. You know, by following this passion, this could be my path to what is love and what is a very attractive lady. And
that's,
you know,
a really,
I feel like,
point.
There's a little bit of that in him is like, yeah, of course he, you know, she's very pretty, so of course he's attracted to her. But I think she does represent like, you know, if I do this right, I could also, you know, get some.
Yeah, and it adds another layer too if she is supposed to be like one of his final girls at one point, you know. Mm-hmm. That's, then he's seen the master do it, so something to strive for.
And I think it speaks to that connection. Like the final girl and the killer always do have some sort of connection, you know, even in Halloween, like before it's established that they're brother and sister, he is drawn to Laurie and she is fascinated by Michael Myers for some reason, you know, Nancy and Freddie are connected. Sydney and Ghostface are connected. You know, it's like, there's just that connection there. And, you know, it could be made, an argument could be made in a world of a slasher movie that the difference between mortal enemies and lovers is very thin in that respect. And I think Eugene represents that. So there is like some aspirational qualities to him having a young, attractive wife.
It's also like Taylor seems, generally speaking, seems somewhat repressed a little bit. Like she is not, like, part of it is that she's fascinated by someone who would be able to go out and do all these things and have like the balls to do this stuff. And, you know, the danger of that is attractive to her.
Oh, people are attracted to passion.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I wonder, too, I guess we can't, I don't want to get into it with the plot, but I wonder if part of Leslie's plan had like a plan B of if things didn't get wonky, like is the end we see plan B? And plan A is to have himself a partner in crime.
That's interesting. I actually didn't think about that.
I didn't until this very moment. Yeah. But I'm wondering.
It is. I will say, like, you know, you're kind of opening up more about this movie for me, honestly, like as we're talking about it. And I was like, oh, yeah, there are some deeper layers here. And I do think so. It's dealing with tropes and stuff. But also, I do think it does say some things about human behavior, actually. So
I think it's like more smoothly saying things that slashers kind of ham-fistedly always have said. You know, like I said, like the crappy morality play that they all are of you misbehave, you get killed. You know, that's very surface level. But, you know, if we extrapolate that, we can get to more human things. And I think that's where this movie's successful. And also where like something like a Cabin Fever is successful. You know, it's although I think Cabin Fever is less about the humans and more about, you know, horror tropes. But
yeah,
you know, but I think this is like part, you know, there is a human aspect to slashers. It has to be there or else they're ineffective. And so to parse that out, I think makes this movie interesting.
So next scene we have is the red herring scene where we get Leslie and the camera crew. They go to the library under the suggestion of Jamie, of her suggesting to Leslie to kill a librarian, because that would be a better, like, indirect killing that would affect Kelly, but not too much.
Yeah.
If it was a friend or whatever. So,
and in a horror movie, it's typically like an adjacent character who kind of helps out a little, innocently helps out, you know, as in the microfilm here.
So we get Leslie, they go into the library, and I like seeing him just jump around like a monkey. Like, it's so like unnatural how he flops around the, so he puts a little paper down that's going to, what was it? That it's going to imply that Kelly's great uncle was the Leslie's mother's rapist or something.
Yeah, it's essentially a photoshopped article.
Yeah, so he puts that there and he kind of has this whole plan of just knowing what she's going to do. She's going to go to the librarian, they're going to look at the microfiche, look it up, and then he's going to kill the librarian, which
is Zelda Rubinstein.
She's been in a bunch of stuff, right? Like I was
her most famous, she's the This House Is Clear lady from Poltergeist.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. She plays the medium that thinks she cleared the house and then finds out she only made it worse in Poltergeist, which, if you haven't seen it, like, absolute stone cold masterpiece.
So everything kind of goes to plan with what Leslie expects. Then he kills the librarian and then Robert Englund shows up and shoots him. Yeah. And he's like, he tells the girl to get close to him, and then you see Leslie jumping on like on top of the bookshelves or something. And it's so bizarre how that all occurs. I kind of love that switches from like documentary filmmaking to,
yeah, it
like
goes into a classic narrative, because up until then it like could be considered found footage. And it's kind of jarring at first because like the movie sort of presents itself as a found footager. And then because I watching it this time around, I was like, wait a minute, I thought this was a found footage movie. And then, you know, as it dances back and forth between classic narrative and found footage, you know, it becomes easier to swallow. But I remembered years ago when I first saw the movie having the exact same thought where I was like, what? And then went, oh, I'm the idiot. This didn't present itself as found footage. It's just portions of it are.
Yeah. Well, they did the intro of the film. We see the dumpster scene, and that's more classic narrative. And then this library scene is when we finally jump back to it. And it is kind of jarring at first. And it's one of the more extended sequences outside of the end of this true narrative. But it's also one of the first times that our crew is kind of witnessing a big part of his plan playing out. So we're kind of witnessing it with them, so to speak. So, and I love when they're looking at the microfiche, and I think it might be after this, there's that throwaway line where he's like, yeah, killers use a lot of CGI, actually. Yeah. He's just, like, talking about, like, the fake articles.
You'd be surprised. I do like, one of the reasons, and this is to jump on what you were saying, John, one of the reasons that I really ended up liking that it goes into a classic filmmaking sense here is that because he's bouncing around in the periphery, mm-hmm. You know, we see behind the scenes of him like hiding in the library stacks, all excited to do, oh, I'll be right back, doing his thing. But like, that is what the killer does in a movie, is they just kind of bounce around in the periphery of scenes like that. And so I think it's important that it ends up cutting to a classical narrative structure, just so that we are reminded of, oh, the reason he's doing this crazy madcap stuff is for this effect as presented here.
Yeah.
You know, it's about that effect.
It's funny to think about how giddy they are when they do this, because he's a little schoolboy. He's just like so excited, probably holding back like giggles and stuff. And I don't know.
In a library too, where you have to be quiet.
Yeah.
That adds to the humor of it, where it's like just positively bubbling over with excitement.
Also, like, he gets shot and then like brags about it later, like, oh, this is my first time getting shot. They're like proud of him. Eugene and Jamie are like really proud that he, like, oh, I had a vest on. Like, no, it's fine. You know, I'm all good.
He's like, good. Wear the vest.
And then, oh, and of course, the best part of that is like, he starts yelling, we got an Ahab. We got an Ahab.
But I like that too. Like, that's why he has such pride, is that he knew to wear a bulletproof vest, because as he understands it, this is where an Ahab, if there is to be one, typically shows up.
Yeah, that's where he's going to show up. Yeah.
This is where Dr. Loomis rolls through, you know? And so, So that was like a badge of honor, where it's like, no, my plan is actually going better than I expected because we have attracted an Ahab.
Yeah. And Leslie was prepared for this, and he's very excited about it. So, John, what is an Ahab for our listeners? How do they explain it in the film?
He's like, isn't he like supposed to represent good or whatever?
Yeah, he just he basically has some sort of connection to the killer from, you know, childhood or earlier in life. And then, you know, kind of becomes obsessed with catching them. And that's what they refer to as the Ahab. And Leslie is aware of the moments where an Ahab is most likely to pop up. So he's preparing for this to happen throughout the film. And he's very excited when it does happen.
For the listeners, the obvious analog is Dr. Loomis in Halloween. You know, he was Michael Myers' psychiatrist or whatever he was, analyst, therapist. And now he's like, you know, he can't be stopped. I have to shoot him. And he shows up, but he shows up exactly in these spots too, where you're like, who is this madman? Oh, he knows more. He's the Ahab.
And before anyone like maybe listens to this and yells at us, we are aware that's from Moby Dick. Like,
yes.
It goes without saying though. Okay. So don't get mad at us.
I've never actually read Moby Dick. And like, I know Captain Ahab is the guy who's out to get Moby Dick. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's what they're referring to. Yeah. Like, so Leslie would be the whale, and he's the guy whose just mission is to take it down, full stop.
Yeah.
You know, no hurdle too high.
I haven't read it either, but I did see, I think they showed us like the 1950 something movie in like class once in like grade schools. So I feel like I've read it.
I mean, that counts. I know that I watched, I guess like 2 years ago, I went through all of the Halloween movies back to back to back, just because like to fill in holes. And if you watch them as a story about Dr. Loomis, it's insane, because he's an insane, dangerous man. He's responsible for the second most amount of deaths behind Michael Myers in those movies. He gets so many people killed, and you watch him just descend into madness. And like, Donald Pleasance ain't no slouch. Great actor. And he you know, even as those movies dip in and out of like lower, higher quality entries, he always shows the hell up and is cranked to like 400. It's incredible. But by the end, you're like, dude, take yourself out of the equation. You are not helping. You're making it worse. But it's so much fun to watch, you know, through his eyes.
Mm-hmm. And it's also like, Jason, I can't remember who said it, but on our episode about Halloween, we thought about it like how the movie wouldn't have changed much if Loomis was actually another patient that got out of Willow's or Grove or whatever.
He's right. Just pissed because like he lost some money to Myers in a game of cards or something. He's just like trying to collect.
Well, we were kind of analyzing it, but like in that movie, the majority of the time that what Loomis is doing is just hanging outside of Michael's house, a place that he knows he was at, and he's just hanging out there scaring away kids. And then he realizes across the street, you can see where Michael's the car that Michael stole is. And then he's like,
yes.
Oh, yeah, I should walk down the street now.
Just turn around, maybe.
Just like go back to work and let the cops handle it. I mean, he straight up directly murders Ben Tramer in the second Halloween. The kid that Laurie has a crush on in the first one that she mentions. In the second one, he gets crashed into it, like pinned against a van by a police car and ignited completely on fire and shot like 100 times. And it's 100% Loomis's fault. And it's great because they don't mention that it's Ben Tramer. It's like later a news report. It's just like Ben Tramer was harder than anybody. It's like, and it's knowing that John Carpenter wrote that script in just like a six pack a night. Like I got to get a script out so that I can see it. Like it really makes sense that he was like, let's just burn them all. But still for Loomis, it's like, man, you just killed a child, like a legit child. You're the murderer right now.
Yeah, I love it.
Oh, it's great. These are not complaints.
No. But I went through the Halloween movies whenever the box set came out by Scream Factory. I got that, went through all of them, and it is wild how many different timelines that they have going on. I think you actually talked about this on Twitter at some point, and we were actually like going back and forth about like what was our favorite timeline. And I wanted to include 4, 5, and 6 because that's just where it gets the weirdest.
It's so weird. What's weird is like, I don't know. I have no preciousness about canon.
Mm-hmm.
Like any amount of those movies I can take or leave, whatever. Like my preferred loop is 1, 2, H2O. Actually, my preferred loop is just 3 by itself. That's like, that's the best one. But at the same time, like 4, 5, and 6 are a great little trilogy.
I think it was funny that I told Jason the plot of the 6th one and like the whole like druid, like stars of the thorn or whatever. And he thought I was lying to him that was the plot. I was like, no,
and
it's
then you're
very
like,
real.
And Paul Rudd is in it. Yeah. You're like, no, you're making stuff up. You are BSing me hardcore.
Yeah.
It's an and introducing Paul. I think it's like Paul David Rudd. It's like it's no lie. And then H2O is an end introducing Josh Hartnett.
Oh, yeah. We haven't seen him in a long time.
Yeah, man, I always liked him, but yeah, he didn't make it.
I heard
probably aged poorly.
Well, I heard something about like he there's a couple big movies he was up for and he like passed on them, and like his like agent dropped him because he wasn't like bringing in enough money or something. Like something crazy like that.
I don't know what it was that he passed on, but I'd be willing to guess that the thing he did that was not great was this movie called Bunraku, Bunraku. After the show's over, watch the trailer for Bunraku.
Okay.
I've not seen the movie, but the trailer is one of those things where you're like, okay, yeah, sure. It's Bunraku. Up there with like Food Fight as like one of those great lost movies that just, you could tell they had high hopes and then just like, we're like, you know what? How about we just call it done today? Even though it's not done, we'll call it done. And then we'll put Josh Hartnett on the top of the poster and let's go get some drinks. You know, like it was one of those. Bunraku.
I'll check that out. I just saw a recent interview, or not a recent interview, but I saw someone post online an interview with Jared Leto where they asked him about urban legends. And he was like, what are you talking about? And he wouldn't admit that he was in the movie. And like, you were the star of the movie. He's like, I would remember that.
All the embarrassing things that Jared Leto admits to on the reg. Urban Legends is like not high on that list. My man's got an island cult of people who worship his dumbass, and he's ashamed of Urban Legends. Yeah. Get out of here. That movie's fun.
Yeah. Well, it's like
I would have remembered that.
But also, the guy keeps bringing it up, and he's like, oh, I mean, I don't know, man. That sounds like a weird, like, he just keeps being like really like affable about it. And it's like uncomfortable then. He's like, is this what you tell yourself when you things happen that you don't like to talk about? Or
you're it's like, let me guess, you've never heard of 30 Seconds to Mars?
Here's an EP. So it's a side note, is this cult going to get dangerous? Like, are we going to have like an HBO documentary in a few years? Like, about how like we all sat back and kind of laughed about it, and then like there's a mass suicide or something. Like, it's getting weird, right?
It is
like
weird.
Church of Mars thing, or is it harmless? I don't know. It seems weird.
I don't know. Like, any cult like that has the potential to get dangerous, but like controversial take time. I think that no matter what happens, I'm ready to laugh at it. So like that's where I'm at. You know, like it's just this world that we live in. You know, yeah. Armie Hammer yeah. eats people. Jared Leto's in a cult. Like what? Yeah, keep it coming. You know,
like, all right, where were we? So we end up back at the diner, right? And that's when Dr. Halloran. So basically the crew is trying to talk to Kelly and try to, you know, figure out what's up, which Leslie said that was off limits. Mm-hmm. But as they're doing this, Dr. Halloran approaches them. He's like, why are you guys filming? Like, what's going on? And then he reveals that Leslie isn't actually Leslie Vernon. He's this other guy, Leslie Mancuso or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mancuso. Cause it's a reference to Frank Mancuso who produced the Friday the 13th movies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. There's a lot of little references like that in here.
This is why it's great to have Dan on. He can do the real
work.
It's
good we have you on. We'd be getting angry emails. I'd be happy to get any email.
You don't even have
to. Like, you listen to the show? It's amazing.
I think one of the things that's so important about the scene at the diner is that it represents the first time that Taylor has decided that Leslie does not know what's best and she's going to do something with her film against his will, because he very specifically said, you do not contact Kelly. You do not affect mm-hmm. this in any way. You are just fly on the wall, you know, pulling the string on the brick. That's the end of your having any action here. And then her and the crew being like, yeah, but let's just go to the diner and see and get some footage is definitely like an ego competition there, where she's like standing up to, you're just going against the rules for a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important for what transpires later, because, you know, the question is then, was she actually supposed to go to the diner?
Yeah. So then we have a scene with Leslie and Taylor talking, and it was outside the diner. Leslie's hanging out there. And he's like, what did I tell you? And he kind of yells at her, and then like he pushes her against the van, and like it looks like he kind of puts his hand on her throat or something. And yeah. It's like a very weird thing, because I mean, I felt like there's some obvious like tension there.
Oh, there's some will they won't they. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some sexual tension there. So then there's another scene after that where they're in his kitchen, I think, and they're talking about what Doc Halloran has said to her about how he's like not really Leslie Vernon, then he used to live in Reno. And I just love that they bring up the Reno part several times. Yeah. You're from Reno. So
I think Reno has the reputation of just like, oh yeah, this is the Vegas that dropped out of school. It's Reno.
Yeah. No, it's just like it's a knockoff town. So he's just like kind of a knockoff serial killer. So yeah, everybody's yeah. gotta bring up.
Yeah, that's true. If there was like a serial killer, like, you know, if he's from some creepy small town, that's great. But if it was just like, you know, striking the citizens of Reno is Leslie, yeah, that was, it just doesn't quite have the same thing as Haddonfield, Illinois, or, you know. Although if somebody set a slasher in Reno, Nevada, like there's probably something fun you could do with that.
Well, oh yeah, casino killer. I'm for
yeah.
it.
Oh yeah.
Or I was thinking just now, like someone in Florida being a serial killer, like would they even notice? Like,
yeah, yeah. Only Dexter would notice.
Oh yeah, I forgot he was there. Him. Yeah,
yeah, he was in Miami.
That show is like kind of like I never finished the show, but it kind of like I don't know, after the finale it kind of just disappeared from like everyone's consciousness, it seems like.
That's a show that peaked before the halfway point.
Yeah.
Like it peaks at the end of season 4. Mm. And it was totally taking a great path, and then they just decided to go a different path, and it just got worse and worse until it just was like a wet fart of an ending, and it just didn't. It's just not good.
Oh man, yeah. I only watched. I watched till season 5, I believe, and then never kept up with it. So.
Yeah, you really have to stick the landing with TV shows, or otherwise people forget, stop talking about
it. That's true. I mean, Game of Thrones like really died because people didn't like the ending. And like that show was a cultural phenomenon, the likes of which we hadn't seen since Star Wars. And nobody talks about it under any circumstances.
Yeah.
And like, the ending was weak, but like, I don't care. At that point, it was, you know, it was fine, whatever. Laser breath. And like, but like that was, you know, that I made peace with it. But yeah, like we don't speak of it anymore. It's very weird.
It's eventually going to be like the Jared Leto interview where like people are like, I was never on that show. What is that called? Game of Thrones. I think I remember that.
11 seat? No. I forget the word.
I love that as a response for something you want to deny. Like, I think I'd remember that. Yeah. I'm going to have to start using that. Like, sir, you have $3,000 outstanding credit card bills. I think I'd remember that.
I guess you're right, sir. Move along. Move along. Well, that's a great defense.
How do we get back on Jared Leto?
We know this isn't going to be in the cut of this.
First off, I think you should totally leave it. And second off, I think this is proof positive that the cult is going to be dangerous because we have fallen down this Leto hole inadvertently. And those people are diving in headfirst on purpose. Anywho.
All right. So we find out that Leslie got a restraining order against Doc Halloran. So that's why he can't actually like get the cops on him, because Doc Halloran would get arrested. And Taylor, like, I think she leaves and she's unsure if she's going to continue. And then they have kind of like a little dramatic scene where she like reconciles with Leslie at his van. And then she's like, we're going to see this through. And then he gets like the bro cameraman are really happy. And then like Leslie kind of like has like a knowing, like nodding his head, like, I know.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And it's funny because there is a little bit of like enmity between, at least from Leslie to the crew.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's sort of dismissive of them and like kind of just like says like passive aggressive things at them. And in that specific moment, it almost could play like two ways. Like one is he's like nodding at him, like, I knew we'd all go back together. Good work, team. Mm-hmm. But as we know, is more just like, you idiots, we're back. the plan is in action. But I also think too, that because of the will, they won't, they energy, he also sort of has the nod that's just like, I'm gonna smash this.
Yeah. You know, like
there's definitely some of that there that's just like, yeah, this bitch can't resist me. You know, like he's got that attitude.
All right. So, now we get to kind of the climax of the movie-ish. So we have like a whole section of the movie where it's Leslie explaining in detail to the camera exactly how the night's going to play out. And I really love this, where he's like talking about how he's, was it like a holding area where he's going to wait for the two kids that are going to go upstairs and have sex, and he's going to wait for the right moment to go in and kill them. And then he has a remote to cut the power, so that way two other people will go downstairs, and then he'll kill one. The other will run upstairs, tell everyone about the murder. Then they freak out. Eventually, he wants Kelly to go to a tool shed and get a big weapon that he has rigged. And
oh, that's a great sequence, too, where he's going through like, oh, yeah, I cut the handle on this.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's going to go flying, but I can't let her hit me once. You know, after that, it's done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he's rigged every weapon to fail, which is what always happens in the movies. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. And he places them very prominently so that they have to take those.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those rigged weapons. Yeah.
And I like how he the way he explains it, though, of like the symbolism of it. He's like, they're holding onto my big hard weapon, they're taking my cock. And like a few seconds later, he talks about like phallic symbols and stuff. He knows how to say it like more like sound more intelligent, but he's like, no, I want to talk about it as my cock.
Yeah, he's still got the bro in him. Even when he doesn't do the the birthing canal, like the cemetery entrance that she runs through, and he's talking about that imagery. Yeah, he gets all smart about it. But
Yannick, he calls it Yannick.
Yannick, yeah. Like, and he's got a
lady
he's
parts.
Still gonna call this cock.
Which is he does sometimes the way he talks about like the other people having sex and stuff. He does get like weirdly like bashful about it, where everything else he can be very like, yeah, man, we're gonna kill them, we're gonna do this. And he's like, well, after they're done with the business or whatever, like he gives
them time to get into it.
Yeah, but the way he talks about it though is a little bit like conservative or something. I don't know the right way to say that, but like
I think that ties into a classic slasher trope. I mean, Jason has no problem punching someone's face off their head, but if he sees them having sex, he can't abide. You know, like, it's kind of a thing. You know, like I mean, the trope is you have sex, you die, but like that we could then presume that in the heart of the killer, who always has no problem with murder, is always a little uptight about it. But I think that speaks to the whole idea of like the way phallic imagery and stuff comes into that is there is a suggestion of repression on the part of all of these killers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's very much a part of Michael Myers, of Jason, not Pinhead. but yeah, like, you know, it's very much a part of it. So to have that in the character of Leslie, I think is a smart choice, mm-hmm. both in the script and in the performance.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess Kelly, after she gets the axe, she's going to go through the orchard, the birth canal, as we were saying. And then she's going to face off against Leslie, and one of them will use the apple press on the other.
Yeah.
Potentially. And I like that he has that plan. And then when the real night occurs, even when the characters are going against what they said they were going to do, and it changes, it's still the same. Like, it's different, but the same. Maybe they changed the order a little bit. Leslie was planning for it as potentially as a plan B, you know?
Oh, yeah. Kelly turns out to be very much not a virgin. That's such a great reveal where it's like, well, maybe it was her first time. And he's like, no, that was not a first time. That's definitely not that. That was so good.
Oh, and the way they the way she's, like, killed off, it is so unceremonious. They're like, don't go out that window. Well,
yep.
Well, he mentions it earlier. He's like, somebody always jumps out the second floor window.
Yeah. So, all right. So like to get to the plot of that. So Leslie goes and he kills the two teens, like he said he would. And that's when Taylor freaks out and, you know, she says like, all right, this is too real. It's actually happening. We should go. And then Leslie's like, I see that look. You're giving that look like you're going to intervene. And no, this is my night.
Yes, that's the best line where it's, this is my night. That was so good the way he did that. Because I almost understand.
Yeah.
Because I've felt that before. Like when I have something set up and then somebody's personal BS gets involved, it's like, I don't have time for that right now. This is important for everything else. Don't make this about you, please. We can deal with that tomorrow.
Yeah.
And no, like, that's what John says to me when I'm dicking around on the podcast too much.
Yeah.
Jason, this is my night. So
this is a horror show, not a Jared Leto discussion panel. We can talk about him tomorrow at lunch. Tonight it's gonna be you laugh with your whole body. I love it. It's amazing. That's such a genuine, powerful laugh.
That's a jiggle more than a.
I'm just soulful, passionate laugh. I love that.
I guess I have like a little bit of a Seth Rogen type of laugh where you can pick out a Seth Rogen laugh.
Seth Rogen, it's distinct. No, it's good though. I came out of the stand-up comedy world. And it would be a dream to have you in the audience, because if I would target jokes at you, knowing that if I got you laughing, it would spread because it's an infectious, passionate laugh. That's a good thing. I hope this is coming across.
Well, no. Yeah. It's, I appreciate it. And I like having that kind of power where I can force laughter onto others.
You could also sink the show if you chose not to laugh. If you could like bring it down and throw jokes and you're just sitting there, arms folded, not feeling it. it could sink the entire show. I'd be like, I gotta find another target in this crowd.
Please don't tell John that that power could potentially be his. I don't know if he would use it exclusively for good.
Behind the laughs, the rise of John Heckler.
He was unhappy with me once because I did reveal to him once that I made a joke that I thought was funny. He didn't laugh in the podcast, and I found a part that was cut later where he laughs. So I moved his laughter under where I said the joke because I believed it. I don't even remember what it was, but I believed in it so much that I was like, no, the rest of the, like, anyone who listens to this, they're going to laugh. They're going to hear him laugh. That's what we're doing. And Jason's like, oh, I didn't know you lied like that. Like,
that's pure evil. I love it. I love it. That's incredible.
You just have a stock library of my laughs and my reactions that you just throw in at your leisure.
Well, so Jason,
he's going to deep fake your audio into like an old Paula Poundstone set and just ruin it.
So, well, Jason laughs at like my jokes and stuff, but like if I can get like a hearty laugh from Jason, I'm like on a high for like a day or two. So like if we have an episode and I say something really funny and he laughs, I'm like, holy shit, was I successful that night?
I did it.
All right, where were we, Jason?
So we as an audience and the filmmaking crew kind of realize at the same time that, okay, Kelly isn't the survivor girl.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an important reveal. Because then at this point, we're like, well, who is? So
I wonder.
So there, the crew is in it now. And we essentially, from this point out, we kind of switch to the more traditional narrative film approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's no longer about this documentary. They're trying to intervene and they're trying to, you know, warn everybody because they know his whole plan, or at least they think they know his old.
It's kind of weird how it's like the camera crew is there without the cameras, but they're there. But then like the kids are kind of like still going through the tropes anyway, even yes. when the even when the other people are commenting on what they're going to see next, they're like, it just like right over the heads. Like
they're like, yeah, whatever, old heads, we're partying. But like, yeah, I think that is, yeah, that's probably, I would think that that's a choice, you know, a writing choice too, that they're just resistant to breaking formula.
And then,
you know, like they don't realize that they're part of a transcending the formula.
Yeah.
But like in that moment, like they don't break the formula because that's, you know, in this world, that's what they know to be. The stoners know they got to be the stoners that are slow in the uptake.
Yeah. And then I like the murders of those guys because it gets like unnecessarily brutal where the one guy like scoops out the guy's heart and then puts it in his hand.
Well, that's another thing though. The stoners always get it hardest, I think, like typically,
yeah,
because they're the comic relief. So they can be dispatched, you know, relatively early on. Mm. They don't have any connection to any other characters except that they're the guys with the drugs. So like it's, you know, yeah. They're red shirts in Star Trek where they're like just expendable. So you can really use like a horrifying kill on them. And I think that is true here.
Yeah.
And we need like an updated take on the stoner characters now that like weed is almost essentially legal everywhere. Like,
yeah. Yeah,
what is
true.
Their new role now? Like,
just gonna be the
we have to like reinvent
methodic.
This character. Like, he's no longer needed.
Got the lovable tweaker who came up to the cabin to tweak out with everybody. And just the whole time they're like, why do we even bring this guy? And then they find out later when he gets, you know, his head punched off. They're like, that's why we bring him.
So
you don't have to be faster than the bear. You just have to be faster than the slowest person the bear is chasing. And that's the tweaker, my friend.
Well, so speaking of that, at a certain point, they all are outside and they're running away from Leslie. And then the fat cameraman, Todd, creates a diversion where he's, hey, Leslie, I'm getting away. You better come get me. And then, unfortunately, you know, he slips and falls and he gets killed. And he's like, Leslie, it's me. It's Todd. It is weird seeing Leslie's face when he's doing this. It's like odd because he's had such a good time with everybody beforehand that it's like you actually seeing his face as he like kills someone. It is like it starts to make it more, I don't know, real or something, you know.
Yeah, he's legit scarier. And I also want to point out they telegraph him falling in the mud, because part of the legend is that on certain nights in the woods, the blood seeps out from the mud. Yeah. And so I think it stands to reason that Leslie has pre-soaked that mud in some type of way in case somebody goes running out there. Mm-hmm. And so it fits the legend, and it just ended up getting Todd.
Listen, I'm going to say this, no surprise here, but I've related to Todd a lot. I would like to try to be a hero, and more than likely it would not go well for me. And it would be kind of embarrassing the way I would go out. So I RIP to a real one. That's what I'm saying.
We miss you, Todd. We miss you. Pour a little out for Todd.
So then they go into like a barn area, and Leslie kills a bunch of the teens that I don't know their names, so it doesn't matter. But I like that Doc Halloran shows up like they expected, and he gets dispatched even quicker than you would have assumed. Like, he just like, and then he gets stabbed and then he falls down and then that's it. And the other guy, Doug, he's like, you'll have to get through me. And then he just, Leslie just knocks him out. And, you know, I liked how fast that was, like the buildup to that. And like, Doug's having a real like moment. And then it's like, no, fuck you.
Yeah, I guess that is sort of like, there is a point in most slashers where it just starts unspooling real quick.
Yeah.
And like at this point where the main victims shift from the kids to the crew, mm-hmm. you know, the kids group starts getting, you know, moved through quickly. I also want to point out that Doc Halloran is likely a reference to Dick Halloran, which was the guy in The Shining who could communicate with Danny
via
The Shining. He was essentially an Ahab of that movie, and also runs into the room to save the day and is dispatched in an instant.
I'm so stupid. I did not make that connection. I just knew, like, Halloran sounds very familiar, and I didn't think to look it up.
John, you're smart enough to have Dan on the show who did make that connection, yes. So...
Yeah, where were you, Jason? Where were you, Jason?
Jason also being a reference to Jason Voorhees. Friday the 13th.
Oh. So we should mention, though, at this point, around this time of the movie, is when we realize that the survivor girl is what's her name? Taylor. So, because... you know, they're like, well, if, you know, Kelly's not the survivor girl, then who is? And, you know, they point out, oh, it's her.
Well, I would ask you guys, when did you kind of figure that out? Because I think it probably telegraphs it earlier than they mean to. But for whatever reason, for me, it still feels very like earned, I guess.
I think it was earned. I was the first time I watched it. And then since it had been so long and I didn't really remember where it was going, both times I was convinced that Taylor was going to be some mastermind that was just trying to film the death of Leslie Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
And then so it still managed to surprise me both times in turning her into the final girl. Question, though, do they establish that she's a virgin?
No, but
because that would be interesting if they did.
Well, there's some foreshadowing in that, because he talks about how he could tell some girl's a virgin, and she goes, well, how would you know? And he's like, you could just tell. You can. And then he rattles off something, but it's kind of implied, I guess, that he can tell that she's a virgin. That's why she is asking like that, because she's like, well, if you can tell that girl's a virgin.
Yeah, that was kind of the point where I started to pick up on it, I would say, at least, you know, this being the first time I saw it. And but I still think it's earned. I don't think it, it really works that way. And, you know, I like how they got there, and you kind of gradually start to catch on that, you know, he was planning for this crew to be here the whole time. And this is, you know, part of his plan. And we talked about it a little bit at the beginning, you know, was this plan B, or, you know, what was his real plan? But, you know, as this plays out, it seems to, for the most part, play out, you know, in a favorable way for him.
Mm-hmm. I would also say, if you're looking at a journalism major that's in grad school, I think that's pretty obvious that she's a virgin. So,
yeah, it's true.
I wasn't sure if that would go over well or not.
I dug it. I'm into it.
So Taylor, she goes to the shed, she gets the axe, and then she goes to the apple orchard. Then, meanwhile, Leslie is messing with her. She I think she hits him with the axe once, and then eventually they both get into the barn with the apple press, and you know, Leslie's choking her, and then she takes his weapon and stabs him and then crushes his skull, it would appear. And you know, to add insult to injury, she burns down the barn.
Well, you know what they say? They always taught us in screenwriting class. If you introduce an apple press in the first act, someone's head has to be crushed with it.
In the final. Chekhov's apple press.
Chekhov's apple press. That's so good. Sorry. I laughed so hard I just brought it to a standstill.
You just had me laughing because it happened so hard.
I just enjoyed that. I don't know. How fucked would that be if it was like, you make me laugh so hard I have a heart attack? I'm like, you're like, you both decide, like, you talk it out for like a couple seconds. You're like, I mean, we really could wrap this up in a good 10 minutes. Then we could get help from John.
I mean, if we were still on my computer, we wouldn't even notice for a couple minutes. You'd be like, wait, is that the lag?
You would just
die?
Freeze and then you'd be gone.
Okay. So, the end of the movie, they have the credits roll, and then you see Leslie wake up from like the what is he at the coroner?
Oh yeah, like the coroner's office. That was a nice touch over the credits.
Yeah, so there is that like sort of supernatural element then at the end, you know. And does this have sequels?
This does not have sequels.
They actually tried to kickstart a sequel, and I think they're a couple $1,000s short. But because I guess at the time they either weren't aware of Indiegogo or it wasn't around yet, that they, because they didn't meet the goal, it lapsed. They couldn't get the money. Everything fell through because of that. And then nowadays they're saying, well, it's been so long that the script they had was like commenting on like the torture porn of that time, of that, that era. So it's like, if they were to actually make the movie now, one, everyone would be a lot older, and two, it might not be very relevant to the movies that they were like kind of satirizing in that sequel that they
wrote. Torture porn is like a subgenre of slasher, whereas slasher is kind of like that those tropes persist, but like the little side channels we take. I would have liked to seen that. That would have been cool.
Yeah, no.
So question about the ending though. This time around, it read to me a little bit, and I don't know if this is necessarily what it's saying, but it would be fun. This is a fun read for me. That Leslie's completion of this ritual was so successful that he is now undead and is now able to exist in a supernatural realm the way that Jason, through sheer force of will, was able to do.
So that's really interesting what you're saying, because that I didn't take it that way, but that makes a lot of sense, because I know that the way they're talking about with the sequel they want to do is they wanted to have like there would be a prequel aspect that would be like kind of documentary-ish or something that's very different. But then like the sequel portion of that movie would have been like he becomes almost like a standard slasher in the vein of Jason or something.
Yes.
So, I mean, that kind of makes perfect sense with what you're saying. And I think, I mean, I'm inclined to believe that.
I don't know if that's what the movie's necessarily, what its intentions are, but like, that's a read that clicked with me this time. And I was like, I'm going to go with that in my headcanon. Well, you know, it could also just be argued that he planned to have gotten, you know, knocked in the head and found some way that we just didn't see around it, you know, and just popped up in the, you know, like, because part of the formula is waking up on the you know, the table, and you know, that's boom, the eyes open up, you know, that's just part of the formula. But I, in my head, I was like, that would be so cool if this was like, no, he did this ritual right and gave himself this undead sort of thing.
That'd be interesting to, you know, have more of an answer to that. I mean, to me, the first time I watched it, it's like, you know, they're kind of getting that one last trope out of the way, you know, how at the end, it's like, you know, it's like the end of Halloween. You know, Michael Myers got up and walked away, or the end of, you know, it's.
They must have spent a lot of money getting Psycho Killer as like the last song.
That was most of the budget there.
It's like Robert Englund, Psycho Killer, and then the rest are like, okay, we gotta watch how we budget.
And then everyone ate like Lunchables the whole time. Didn't have a budget.
Craft Services didn't even spring for the pizza Lunchables. They just did ham and cheese.
The worst ones.
Like, you couldn't even go for turkey and cheese. Come on.
Have you guys discussed Lunchables on Hot Property? I feel like that's that one.
We have not. We do discuss a lot of snacks, so I think Lunchables will eventually make it. But so far, it's been like pockets and pies sort of stuff. We've done Hot Pockets and Pop Tarts, and not through any planning. It's just by sheer chance of that was what was being eaten.
Nice.
Tell you what, though, no matter what way you cook a Hot Pocket, it's going to be garbage.
So that was
they dropped off. They're not good anymore. And maybe I was just young and idealistic, or they dropped in quality, or both, because they were terrible unilaterally.
I think it's probably both.
Did
you probably fry them? Was that attempted?
I did do the air fryer as one of them, and that was actually the best. That was the best preparation. Oh, nice.
I could see it.
So, Jason, at this point in our series, we've seen Peeping Tom, Psycho, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Black Christmas, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, and Scream. And now we're including Behind the Mask. I mean, up until this point, we've been pretty overt about how it compares to all other slasher movies.
Let me tip my cap to you for the sequencing of these, because this was a very natural follow-up to Scream, I felt, and it was kind of an extension of that. You know, you got a little bit of the parody aspect, you have the rules, which they go over in Scream, and then you kind of see them put into practice in this one. And, you know, I think it's a nice bundle of everything we've seen so far. I mean, obviously, specifically the ones that they're targeting are more Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th. Those are, you know, I'd say the big ones. But yeah, I mean, I think it was great to watch this right after Scream. I really enjoyed it. And it was refreshing to have the more comedy spin on everything we've watched so far.
Yeah, and I think it does seem like this movie is a little underappreciated compared to other movies in the slasher genre. So I thought it was kind of a good idea to cover it here, so that way we could kind of maybe get some more people to check it out. It's on Amazon Prime right now. So
yeah, I don't know. I mean,
and Joey will lend you the Blu-ray.
I hope Joey, here's the thing. I'll know if Joey listens to this episode, because I know if he does, he's going to get a kick out of this. Yeah. But if I don't hear from him, then I know he didn't fucking listen to the show anymore.
You're going to get a call that's going to be like, that's right, you do have my movie.
Well, that's all he'll take away from it.
To be fair, he has my Blade Runner Blu-ray, so it's like mutually assured destruction. Like, if we don't.
I saw many years ago, I was reading a guitar magazine, and it was ranking the top 50 metal albums of all time. Mm-hmm. And included, low ranked on the list, but included in the list were both the Spinal Tap album and the first Tenacious D album. And the person who wrote this article penned a very strong defense, and they said, you know, no art can truly be understood without parody, and no parody can truly be successful without a grasp of the art. And that's why they included Spinal Tap and Tenacious D. And that really resonated with me. And I think when it comes to things like Scream and Behind the Mask and, you know, Cabin in the Woods, is they're not poking fun in a way that is reductive to the form. They're poking fun in celebration of the form, while also demonstrating a control of how these movies are made. And so I think when you compare this to other slashers, it compares, you know, quite well, just because it is a good slasher. And the satire angle, you know, is almost just like cherries on the sundae there, because it's actually a good, you know, like Shaun of the Dead. If that wasn't also a solid ass zombie movie, it wouldn't be bona fide all time classic that it is. And so, I think that in stacking this up against other slashers, it's just worth noting that it's in its own right, it's a pretty wicked little slasher that just also is real smart. So I think doing this after Scream, you're right, is a really smart choice.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's well said. And I think you're right. You know, if you couldn't have made a film like this without a respect and an appreciation for the genre, you know, you just like you said, it's, you know, it's more paying respect to it while calling attention to these tropes. And I think we mentioned in the Scream episode, you know, it's not something like, you know, Scary Movie that's literally just like kind of making fun of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a more clever aspect to this. And you're right, it is effective as a slasher film on its own.
It's like Scary Movie's almost saying, like, why do we like this ridiculous shit? Whereas these movies are saying, like, this is why we like it.
So, Dan, the question is, would you survive this killer?
Oh, man, I would like to say yes, but I watched this movie twice and both times the reveal got me, which leads me to believe that Leslie Vernon would have been a step ahead of me. So I'm going to humbly say no, probably not. Also, because I probably would have approached like, yeah, I'll survive this. And he would have known that I was the cocky type and I would like step in a bear trap and that's it. You know, like, the end. So no, I don't think I would have survived the slasher.
Jason, what about you?
This one's tough. So I'm thinking of this from the perspective of who I would be in this scenario. And I feel like I would be like the guy behind the camera. And I don't know. I feel like that would make me a target. I feel like I would, if this was like a grad school thing.
Yeah,
I would probably be the guy trying to make sure like everything is in order. I'd be too distracted, like charging batteries and like, you know, so figuring out like the location scout for the day, figuring out like when the sun is going to be at the best angle to shoot certain things. And I would totally miss the fact that we are becoming part of this because I'd just be wearing so many hats. So
let me just tell the audience here. I've worked on a set with Jason where we took a break for lunch and his food was there and I was like sitting there eating and like trying to prevent other people from taking his sandwich. And he is still setting up the lights for the next scene because he wants to get that done first. So like he is a hard worker.
What you want on a set, man.
Yeah. But like I could see Jason being like, all right, well, let me set up this light here and you can do the kill shot, blah, blah, blah. And then I would say something later. It'd be like, Jason, are we cool with this murder stuff? And you're like, oh, isn't fake? I thought this was
this is fake. Where I set up the light and I'm like testing, like I got my light meter out and I'm like, all right, guys, who's getting killed in this shot? And everybody's just staring at me. I'm like, who's getting killed in this shot? And he's like walking up behind me.
And, so like you're getting killed. You're like, shit, I'm about to walk. You're like, we need makeup.
But yeah, no, I think I'm dead this time. John, what about you?
So for me, as I mentioned earlier, what happened to Todd is what would happen to me. 100%.
Yeah.
I would slip and fall in the mud and then kind of feel like, it's me. Come on. I'm the big goof. Come on.
And like, listen to this laugh. You know what you wanted. Come on. Spread some joy.
I actually hate hearing my laugh and I edit the stuff. So it's like, it's a weird purgatory.
Nah, embrace it, John. Embrace it.
I mean, anyone who's listened up to this point in the podcast, I think they have to at least be like slightly positive on my laugh or like they're like really angry about it.
Like, whatever. Reaction is what you want. You know, hate clicks are worth two. If the world has taught me anything, that's like, I mean, come on. Is there a truer fact in the world of media right now? Hate clicks count for double, man.
Dan, what I've always enjoyed on seeing your tweets on Twitter is whenever there's some sort of hot take opinion going around and people are getting mad about something, you're like, who cares? Let people enjoy things. And I was like, man, Dan has such a healthy outlook on some of this stuff.
He's so enlightened.
Yeah.
I try not to tweet as much anymore just because it drives me nuts. Yeah. Because my timeline is filled with smiles and sunshine. And that's just because I'm tamping down seething, horrifying rage inside my heart. So, you know, so the positive outtake is what's advertised. Yeah, but as my soul dies slowly, that's what's really happening. No, but I just think, you know, we often film Twitter is one of those things where everyone gets all crazy and like we just forget like this is supposed to be fun.
And I like how like you and Garrett always seem to spend a lot of time with like on movies that you number one that you like and kind of like advocating why these movies are good, what you enjoy. And like I feel like you two kind of create like an infectious kind of vibe about that. And you know,
thanks.
As someone who is naturally negative and wants to be nicer and more positive, I appreciate what you're like putting out into the world. So
well, much appreciated. Let me try. One of my buddies, Evo, shout out to Evo, one of the best writers I ever met. He always said, with every piece of media he consumes, you should try and find two things you like about everything you hate and one thing you hate about everything you like.
That's good advice.
It's good advice, you know, because even if it's just something just like, you know what? That was a great color choice in a movie that's garbage. Mm-hmm. Like to find that is like that reminder of like, you know what? Like this movie could just be trash, but 500 people got paid and worked hard and put this together and had passion for it. And, you know, someone loves it. So they can have it.
It can also help you appreciate other people's perspectives too when you do that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think just as of late, like the last year or two, I've been getting more into like the like giallo films or like kind of more underseen like horror films from the 70s and 80s and stuff. And it's nice to see like people that are, you know, certain directors that maybe aren't like household names or whatever that are like workman like directors that, you know, they put out stuff, they either made money or they didn't. And then like nowadays, like there'll be like a, I don't know, like Severin or Arrow will release like a nice edition of their movie and it gets like reevaluated again or something.
Oh,
and like,
yeah.
It does kind of show that not every movie has to have some sort of prestige surrounding it or behind it. You know, like not every director has to be a Scorsese type or something like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's different ways that you can appreciate, you know, good directors, actors that do kind of a particular type, you know, things like that. And I've been enjoying, you know, seeing more diverse things like that and kind of realizing film means different things to different people. And there's just so much to enjoy out there. And
There's no one central canon, you know, there's, mm-hmm. there's good and bad everywhere. And like, I don't know, it's just all, I love movies. They're cool. It's like good shit.
You like movies.
I do indeed.
All right, that does it for this week's episode. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. And next week, we will be reviewing You're Next. Until then,
stab you later.
Well, there is a movie that Luca Guadagnino and Timothée Chalamet are making a movie about a person who eats people, and Armie Hammer is like not in that movie, so it's like they're like, oh, we don't let.
It's called Cook Me by Your Flame. Oh man!
And that's our show.
Oh.